Welcome to The Liberated Life, the podcast for women who are done pretending that they have it all figured out and are ready to live with more freedom, clarity, and courage. I'm Lucy Maeve, your guide on a journey through the unspoken parts of healing, desire, and self-discovery. This is a place to be seen, heard, and held, where we embrace all the complexities and contradictions of being fully alive. No masks, no shortcuts, just the real work and real liberation. Hello, my lovelies. Welcome back to the Liberated Life podcast. I'm so excited to be here with you. We have such a juicy episode for you today. I have my incredible friend, Belle, who joins us all the way from sunny Brazil whilst I'm sitting here in 1 degree London. Belle is an eternal seeker of self and a devoted researcher of love. She's a psychologist and mentor specializing in love, relationships, and pleasure. Her approach integrates psychology, neuroscience, and spirituality through a somatic lens. This episode is so juicy. Belle is incredibly wise, wise beyond her years. It feels like she's lived about 17 million lives on this earth, despite being in the youthful body of a 28-year-old with incredible, beautiful Brazilian skin, which made me very envious. But we talk all things relationships, love, Instagram relationships, and how dangerous they are, what it really means to be in love with someone, what it really means to be loving, why we don't have the relational education that we all need, and a few practices that you guys can take away to support you to feel more pleasure in your life, to experience more enjoyment in your life, and generally to live in a more liberated way. I hope you enjoy this episode. It was a joy to record, and I will see you here very soon. Okay, so here we are with the beautiful Belle, who has turned up looking like an absolute Brazilian goddess. And I'm sitting in London winter being like, ah, she looks so sunny and beautiful and tanned. but it's been beautiful to have you here. Thank you for doing this with me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And I'm so excited for this conversation because I have seen, ever since we did Vita together, I've seen you like go from strength to strength on Instagram, talking about such incredible topics. I also saw you pop up on like a relationship. I can't remember who it was, but it was like a relationship coach's feed that she was talking about why like you had to make men chase you and how it was important to have a man like you more than you like them, or love you more than you love them. And I saw you reply in the comments with this like really cutting Belle response about love not being about possession, and I was like, I must talk to Belle on the podcast. So here we are.
Oh, I love that. I love how it's just like going into like Instagram and being mad about crazy people, what crazy things that people say, and then you find me and I'm like, and you're like, yes,
yeah, totally
do it,
totally. And also I feel like this is actually quite an interesting starting point for me because I am genuinely concerned about Instagram and about a lot of the messages about love and relationships that show up on Instagram. It's like clickbaity, possession based like idea about like somehow winning a man, and I'm honestly quite concerned about the state of our relational world right now and the fact that we are being taught really horrible narratives about love. And I feel like you in your work and in everything you study embody such a pure essence of what it actually means to be loving, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, if you have any thoughts.
Yes, I think we live in the world today that is very polarizing. And in relationships, if you want to have a good relationship, you can't polarize. It's not black and white. And Instagram really likes black and white. That sells. And what I notice is a lot of clients of mine, they question their own relationship and they question their own feelings because of something they saw on Instagram. So they go like, oh, you know, I don't know if I should be accepting this from him, because I saw this girl on Instagram talking about how if man says this, then that's not accept. And then I keep one question that I ask my clients often is, what would your relationship look like without Instagram? How would you feel about it? What boundaries would you actually have? What would actually bother you if you weren't like listening to an influencer, or maybe even comparing your life to perfect relationships on Instagram that only shows the good sides? You know, so I think, and then not even going into how, I think one of my biggest concerns around social media and relationships is how we, in social media, we have an algorithm that shows us exactly what we think, what we like, and reinforces our way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you follow someone that you like, and then they say this one thing that you don't agree with, and then you're like, unfollow. Mm-hmm. Just like that. You dismiss everything that you like about that person, and you cut her out completely. And then you are faced in relationships with another person that disagrees with you, that is a whole other world. And we are lacking the inner capacity and the inner world to stand confrontation, to stand disagreement, and to be in peace while we disagree because of algorithm. And then I think this is going to be enhanced with AI, because we have artificial intelligence that just reinforce what we believe. Mm-hmm. And I was looking into studies that showed that in the past 20 years, our capacity for empathy lowered 40%. Mm-hmm. We lost 40% of it, because it's something that we learn to be empathic with someone that thinks different than what we do. Mm-hmm. And that's what relationships are all about.
Totally. I actually found out something very similar to that piece about empathy, about how our capacity for critical thinking, which is obviously interrelated, has also reduced a huge amount, because we can't, we're so used to receiving such simplified messages about things that are inherently complicated. Like when I look at like my own relational world and the relational worlds of some of the people that I work with, it is not as simple as there being a quick fix for anything. It's not like follow these five steps and somehow you will magically magnetize a partner and it'll all be wonderful. It's like you've got two very complicated systems coming together, and I worry that we are being given a relational education that is so unbelievably limited, and then people are confused about why relationships are so difficult.
Absolutely, we're lacking every single skill that we need for relationships. And then we're dying because of it. You know, like loneliness is as harmful for the body as smoking a pack of cigarette a day. Like, that's how messed up we are right now. But I truly believe, like, I really believe there's a new generation and people that are awakening for different ways of relating, and that social media is not becoming like such a major part of their lives. And I'm really hoping for that.
And I'm intrigued, like you to me, when I first met you, you come across as someone who I'm gonna say that you're like 50, but actually you're like 13. Like you have the wisdom of someone that has lived many, many, many lives, and yet you have the skin of someone who has and I'm wondering, like, you come across as someone that has so much wisdom and so much depth to share, and I'm wondering, like, was this how you were born, or has this been like an evolving sense of self and a lot of work?
It was definitely a lot of work, but I started really early. So at my grandma, when I was 8 or 10, my grandma would take me to Ayurvedic retreats where we would meditate. So there was a little bit of that. And then I distanced myself from that. But eventually I found my way back through ayahuasca, which is a plant medicine that comes from the Amazons. and when I was 18. So I spent 4 years of my life dedicated in studying ayahuasca and the medicines from the forest, doing many ceremonies and being with the native people from Brazil. So that's when my spiritual path began. But the thing about the space of ayahuasca and the culture around ayahuasca is people are looking for healing. And I was looking for healing. So at that time, I had an eating disorder. Eating disorder that doctor said that there was no cure for it. And I would spend my whole life in treatment.
Wow.
So I started seeking for alternative ways. Like I could not imagine my life being on meds, like psychiatric meds forever. So I went into ayahuasca looking for that healing. And I eventually got exhausted of looking for healing. Like when do we, I was thinking like, when do we stop healing and we start living? When do I stop like waiting for something to change so I can finally enjoy my life? And then I met Tantra in 2020. And then I dedicated like my entire life, and I would do like 4 hours of practice a day in looking to pleasure. And so I first met Neo Tantra. And I did like many, many hours of practice that was based on pleasure. And then in 1 year, I was completely free from the eating disorder. And my body, that my relationship to my body changed. The way that I saw life changed. My ability to love myself, my relationship to food, to nature, to others completely changed. And this was mind-blowing because I was like, I spent 4 years doing traditional like medicine, modern medicine healing, like taking meds and going to therapy and going to nutritionist and da-da-da. Yeah. And then I did 4 years of plant medicine. And then in 1 year of Tantra, all of that was like gone. And yeah.
I feel like at this point, whenever I say to people that I did a training that had like some elements of tantric philosophy within it, people automatically go like, oh, wait, like Tantra is in like having gangbangs, basically. There's, I mean, unless you were in the spiritual world, there is a, I think that there's a misconception about what Tantra is actually about. And I wonder for you, how do you explain that philosophy that you started stepping into to people that are perhaps less aware of it?
Yeah. So I think the first thing about Tantra is the non-duality of it. And I don't think of Tantra as a philosophy. I think of Tantra as a practice, or rather like many practices together. And of course, it has a way of viewing life. So there is a philosophy behind it, but you can't think your way through Tantra. You know, like, just like you can't think your way through enlightenment or healing. Like that doesn't work. So when I'm, when I explain Tantra to people, the first thing I say it's about non-duality is it's a way of looking at life, not as black and white, not as good or bad, but as God manifesting itself in everything at all times. So the one thing that every tradition talks about when they talk about God is they're, oh, I don't know if I know how to say this in English, but they're everywhere, they're in everything, and like all the time.
Yeah.
You know, there are three words for this, but I don't know them.
Omnipresent and omni-something else.
Right. Exactly. So that's the one thing that every tradition says about God. So how come God is not in the war? How come God is not in my rage? It is. Right? So how do we find God in those spaces? And that's how Tantra was created. It was created as a non-renunciation path. You don't need to give up your mundane life, your relationships, alcohol or red meat or money or things that you enjoy. You need to find God in it. So I think that's what Tantra is like for me.
It's so fascinating because you talk about it with so much. Like, I can feel the energy behind the words that you're saying, and it just comes across as so pure and so true. And I also, in my own experience of like starting to dip my toes into those waters, there is so much conditioning around consumption and around pleasure that gets like muddies the waters in this world, because I feel that there is a fine line between like allowing pleasure to be some form of spiritual practice and a healing practice and finding God in pleasure and using pleasure to cope. Because if I think back with my own journey, I never used to say to myself that I had an eating disorder, but in all honesty, I had big binge episodes. So I would have these like frantic moments of just eating like inordinate amounts of sugar, really, as some way of coping from my like deep existential loneliness and like self-hatred. Yeah. And I look back and at that point in my life, I was using pleasure to numb. And I know a lot of people will use sex as a way to numb, or any other form of like hedonism, really, to numb. And I wonder for you, as someone who has used pleasure in such a profound way on your own journey, what is the difference between using it as a healing tool and a capacity to connect with the divine and coping?
Yeah, I think that's the first thing that we need to establish before we go into the topics of this podcast, like what is actually pleasure, right? People talk about pleasure in this world as distraction. It's a distraction. It's not real pleasure. It's what Layla, our teacher, called a dopamine hit, a good dopamine hit, she says, which is good sometimes. Mm-hmm. Right? It's nice to sometimes scroll through Instagram or eat fats and sugar, and that's fine, but it's not real pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
The distracting type of pleasure, it's based on escaping from pain.
Mm-hmm.
The real pleasure exists in pain as well, because it is. It's based on presence. And if I invite you and the listeners right now to just relax your body and take a deep breath, intending pleasure, just, and maybe let some pleasurable sound out. It's right here. It is right here. You know, and I can eat chocolate and not feel any pleasure, and I can eat chocolate with all my presence and devotion to that flavor, and then it's real pleasure, you know. So that's, when we talk about pleasure, that's what we're talking about. Real pleasure, release oxytocin, serotonin, it activates the parasympathetic nervous system. It's deeply healing. While distracting pleasure is based on a hyperactive sympathetic nervous system that is just on fight and flight, and that is flight.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
So what you're saying, in effect, is like we're dealing with a misdefinition of what pleasure actually is. And so people stepping into this and hearing you speak, be like, wait, using pleasure to heal, is that me just going and like scrolling on Instagram or going and sleeping with loads of random people after five shots of vodka or whatever? But that's a misdefinition.
Absolutely. Because we have a few myths around pleasure. And one of the biggest ones is that pleasure comes from outside. Pleasure comes from outside of us. Something external is going to bring us pleasure. We all operate in some level in that myth. But that's conditioning. That's not true. Like I said, I can eat a chocolate like on automatic, like driving my car, and feel no pleasure. Or I can take that chocolate and smell it and put it in my mouth and have like this just energetic experience of melting into that chocolate. So it's really about the inner state that you're in towards pleasure. Another myth that we carry around pleasure is that we need to do something to deserve it. And women carry a lot of that, right? It's like, oh, after I clean the house, or if I am a good girl, or if I finish all the work, then I'll allow myself to relax. Then I will get the pleasure. If I lose weight, then I will feel happy. If I get the relationship, then I will feel pleasure. It's from outside, and I need to do something to have it. And in reality, like, it's right there. It's presence. And like I said, we can feel maybe pleasure in pain and in grief or in rage. I'm connected to that deep presence in my body. It's everywhere all the time.
Yeah. And as you're talking, it makes me think about like how it really is, in essence, like a connection of the divine that moves through us is that experience of pleasure. And at the same time, I'm remembering back in like 2016, whilst I downloaded the Headspace app and tried to start meditating for the first time, and was like, this is not pleasurable. Like, sitting still is not pleasurable. And in all honesty, like when I started the Layla training, and I still have a long way to go with this, I found it really hard. I was like, I don't understand how everyone is having these like hugely ecstatic experiences from these practices. Like, I'm literally not feeling anything. And I'm wondering for you, like you mentioned in your little spiel that you gave me before we did this, like that you experienced yourself as quite rigid previously when you were in your eating disorder. How easy was it for you to get into a place where you could connect to this form of pleasure that isn't the dopamine hit?
Yeah, one thing that I didn't mention that I think is worth mentioning is when I had an eating disorder, the reason why I went looking for tantra was because I couldn't orgasm at all. So I had my hormones, I had no hormones, I didn't have my period for 2 years, and it was nearly impossible to get an orgasm. So people told me, go look for tantra, it might help. So I did. And I think slowly you start noticing that your body can feel pleasure. Like, if I just put my fingers in my arms very slowly, there is feeling, there's sensation in there. We don't need high intensity of pleasure to feel pleasure. We need deep presence and surrender. That's what's necessary to find pleasure. And yes, rigidity will keep you from pleasure. And pleasure, it's also the pathway to break rigidity. So it's a paradox, right? But like, from a neuroscience perspective, pleasure is the most efficient way to shift our brain from defensive states. So it increased activity in the prefrontal cortex. It released oxytocin, natural opioids, all the things that I talked about. And it tells the amygdala, relax. Right now we're safe. We can soften. So I like to think about pleasure as the next level of safety. Like, we feel safe, that's great. Our body can relax. If we feel pleasure, it's like an enhanced state of safety. Which new neural pathways can open. And the thing is, when we do connect with pleasure, all the layers, all the conditioning of what is keeping us stuck in rigidity will show up, right? All the stuck patterns that keeps you contracted, because that's what trauma is, right? That's what keeps us rigid. It's this contraction in the body. And pleasure is the opposite of that. It expands and it softens the body. And when you expand and you soften the body, all those energies that were stuck in your body keeping you rigid, they're going to show up. And you're going to have to face hard emotions. You're going to have to face how you've been sabotaging your own life in your own relationships. You're going to have to face all of that. That's going to be painful. So I think part of why we run from pleasure is because in pleasure, there's a deep sense of safety that is unfamiliar for a lot of people. There's a sense of unworthy for a lot of people. And it's going to make you face a lot of your demons and a lot of your pain. And we have to have the inner capacity to hold that, which is why a good therapist will help. But, and then this is another thing, you can't just look to your pain. If you want to heal your rigidity, you can't just look to what makes you rigid and the pain that it's keeping you stuck. And I think that's where psychology got it wrong. Like, I'm a psychologist. I went to to like psychology school, but I think that's where we really got it wrong, because we keep looking into the pain.
Yeah.
We keep looking what's keeping you rigid. Oh, what happened in your childhood? Oh, yes, you're like this because your mom was like that. And then we have all the reasons why, and we understand why, and we keep talking about our pain. So we're reinforcing the neural pathways that keeps us stuck in pain, that looks towards pain. And what pleasure does is pleasure teaches our nervous system a different way to exist in the world. Opens up new pathways that shows, okay, yes, all of this came to your from your parents, your childhood. There's this generational trauma. Larari. Okay, great. We look at this. But then what? And I think this then what? It has to have pleasure involved. Because the life that you want is pleasurable. If you want to be soft and feminine and have great orgasm, it's pleasurable. So you can't just look at the pain.
No. It's something that I've thought about quite a lot in my own journey, because I spent a long time looking at pain. And it was only when I started doing breath work, actually, that I started having experience, like naturally, experiences of like ecstasy or of like joy or anything else that wasn't just me looking at my anger or my grief, whatever else. But I do think that there's a big piece, and I think a lot of people are in this place right now because a lot of this work has become much more mainstream. People are like, I understand why I have these problems, but what the hell do I do about it?
Yeah, exactly.
We are so educated on our own trauma patterns and on our relational patterns, and we can talk about it, but it makes no difference having the awareness.
Exactly. And that's where people are stuck right now. They know where their pain comes from, but they don't know what to do with it.
And I wonder, as someone who has done so much pleasure work and has really softened from a space of rigidity into what I perceive as someone that is very much embodied in their softness, what is the link for you between capacity to feel pleasure, capacity to feel soft, and our experience of love? Because I hear from a lot of people that they're like, I want love. Like, I just want to feel like love with my partner. I want to feel blah, blah, blah. And again, going back to the point you made earlier, there's a big, big piece, which is like, he's not making me feel love, or like, something in this relationship is wrong, and that is why I don't feel love. And increasingly, it's like, is that the problem? Or is it actually that you're currently so guarded to your own experience of love and pleasure that it would be impossible to feel it even with the most perfect partner in the world?
Yeah. Absolutely. The thing people don't get, I think, is you can't feel love if you don't feel safe. You are never going to perceive love, and you're not never going to perceive pleasure if you don't feel safe. So safety is the first step.
Can you, for people that think that safety means not being in a place where you're about to get beaten up by someone in a dark alley, how would you describe what safety actually means relationally for someone who's in a relationship that isn't abusive, for example?
Yeah. Safety comes first from your own self. It's a somatic experience. And if I ask you, where in your body can you feel safety right now? Maybe there is a part of your body that is a little bit more soft or a little bit warm, right? So creating awareness of your body and the inner state of your body, I think, is the first step towards understanding safety and creating a new inner ecology of safety. I cannot be in a relationship. There's nothing my partner can do to make me safe if I don't have an understanding what safety is in my body. If I never had the experience of safety, maybe I grew up in a household where I was never safe. So I don't know the experience of safety, or even maybe safety feels dangerous because it's unfamiliar. And I see this in a lot of women, especially like high, like bossy woman, which is I forgot what I was going to say.
Safety feeling unsafe.
Yeah. Oh yes, that they need to be so productive and they need to control everything. And the experience of control looks familiar to safety in a way that when they relax, they feel unsafe.
Oh, Belle, you're talking to me right now.
Yeah. And I recorded a reel for Instagram yesterday where I said, everything is okay in my life. There's no big problem that I need to solve. And it's so scary to say that out loud because there's a part of me that is a bit anxious. Like, there must be something that I'm not seeing. There must be something that I'm missing. And I'm going to be caught by surprise in the next corner. And isn't that crazy? We don't know how to relax and enjoy life and just be where we are. We're seeking the next project and the next, and you know, and this hyperactivity and this controlling of things, they feel like safety, but they're control.
It's an escape, isn't it? Like, if I think back to my life, I know I still definitely have tendrils of this, but like, it was running away. It was like, if I can just keep running, then like the next thing will be the thing that makes me happy. It's again, the externalization as well. Like, when I get the promotion, I'll be happy. When I do this project, I'll be happy. When I get this many followers on Instagram, I'll be happy. And a real lack of capacity to slow down. And I remember when I first met my partner, he comes from a world which is like just much more slow moving than central London life. And I realized, like, in the winter in South Africa, like, there's not very much happening. Like, it's not like the city continues in the winter. It's like a period of hibernation. And I was like, but what do we do? Like, what's happening now? Like, what's going on? There must be like things on and stuff to see. It's like, no, people just like chill. And it felt so threatening to my nervous system to be like, oh, I'm allowed to just rest. I'm allowed to just be without producing anything. And I mean, it makes sense to me why people have like panic attacks when they start trying to slow down. Like, people that get made redundant or suddenly have a period off work and they can't receive the beauty of it.
Yeah. We really don't know how to enjoy everything that we have accomplished. And I'm sure that you and people listening today, they live a dream that a few years ago was a dream. Today they're living it and we don't know how to enjoy. And I went through this recently. I looked at my life and I was like, I have everything I have ever wanted. Why am I not happy? Something must be wrong. I need to become the most requested tantra teacher in Brazil. And then I was like, it's never, what's happening right now?
It never ends.
So I think, if we want to have thriving relationships, if we want to move out of survival mode, we need to teach our nervous system to rest. We need to teach peace to our bodies, which is crazy. How come we don't know peace? But we don't.
No.
So, yeah, we need to find safety and I think pleasure. And then we can start with sexual pleasure, right? Sexual pleasure is a deep state of surrender.
Mm.
You are more, it's easier to create new neural pathways. You're in a state of consciousness where you can change the way you see the world, which can be really dangerous. If someone tells you horrible things while you are turned on, that will stay in your system. But it can be a beautiful way to maybe like practice surrender while you're doing self-pleasure practices.
Mm.
And I started with self-pleasure, like sexual pleasure practices. And I would do like deep self-love practices towards my body, towards my pussy, towards start loving my body again. And a huge shift for me was like, how can I hate something that gives me so much pleasure? Something's off here. That's when I started. So yes, we can start with sexual pleasure, right? We can use that as a tool. When you're feeling pleasure, you're also in a deep state of safety. So it's a great way to start changing the way that we see. And then eventually we have to start bringing this into our everyday life. Can I be with the food that I'm eating and enjoy every bite? Can I be in the arms of my lover and just relax into it, even though there's dishes that I need to do when they're looking at me? Can I take a moment to breathe and then I'll do the dishes? Like, can I give myself 30 seconds?
Mm-hmm.
I started like that. Like, can I stay in this hug for 30 seconds and then I'll do the dishes? Like, I would make agreements with myself, like contracts. Okay, just like 40 seconds. I'm going to breathe for 40 seconds and then I'm going to send that email. And then eventually, like, we create resilience and inner capacity to hold pleasure and presence.
I wonder, when you said that you had that period recently where you were like, I have everything that I want and I'm like, something must be wrong, I'm not happy. What is your go-to practice as like a pattern interrupt when you recognize that happening? Because I go in cycles of this. I'm like, I'll have periods where I'm like, oh, I feel really good, like I'm just doing my practices, I'm doing my stuff, it all feels good. And then suddenly I'll be like, I need to somehow achieve some huge goal in order to feel good enough. What do you do when you notice yourself in that cycle to switch out of it?
One of the things I do is to look at everything that I'm doing. So sometimes I go into that and I think, oh, but I should be putting out, there's this mentorship that I want to put out in the world and I should be creating more content. Oh, and I have that course that I need to study and la 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 and all the things that I'm not doing. And then I take a breath and I tell myself all the things that I am doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, I launched a mentorship this year. And I'm understanding myself again on Instagram. And I'm enjoying life with my partner. Like, I've been going to waterfalls and the beach almost every day. And I'm doing yoga at the beach in this beautiful, wild beach in Brazil. And then I show myself the things that I am doing, even if they're not in service of capitalism. Like, oh, but I've been going to the beach every day. Oh, but I'm eating organic food that I've been preparing freshly every day. Look at the things that I'm doing. And I also remind myself I'm 28, you know, and that can go for every age. Like, oh, I'm just 55. Oh, I'm just 80. That's very little time in earth to do everything that we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we also need to, and I think Tantra is really helpful in this, because Tantra tells us that everything happens in expansion and contraction.
Mm-hmm.
Expansion and contraction. And sometimes we are in a moment where we are more contracted and we are so mad that we are not producing as much. In women, this happens every month, right? We get our period and then we go back into ourselves and then we're ovulating and then we're more towards the world. And this happens in longer cycles. So last year when we were doing Vita, I was doing all the practices and going into every call and do like la 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 la. This year, this entire year, I was like, I don't want to do any practice.
Mm.
I don't want to do anything. I don't want to study this. I just want to go to the beach and waterfalls every day. And I had some panicky, like, I'm not doing everything. But then I remind myself that when we are up here, the only thing that we can do is come down. There's no other way to go more up. We have to come down. So allow yourself to be down.
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
It's the obsession with being in perpetual summer. And it's interesting for me because I spent like 3 years without a proper winter because I was in Cape Town and then I'd come to London in the Cape Townian winter and somehow ended up missing winters. And coming into the winter in the UK now, I'm like, oh my God, my body needs this so badly. Like we need the period of respite of like, we're not meant to be in this constant state of blooming or growing. Yeah. Like we are meant to be sometimes in the state of like death and decay, but we have so much fear of death and decay that we just try and run away from it with the dopamine hits.
Yeah, exactly. And then bringing up Tantra again, like, I think that's where we really got it wrong because when we anchor ourselves in non-duality, nothing is good or bad. It's just consciousness experiencing itself through us and it has a message. So like when we see that God is speaking to us through our rage, through our procrastination, through our inability to love and be present, it's talking through us to through everything that's happening. Then we start listening. And I think that's the major like shift, right? I think that's the big thing. When you stop fighting what's happening and you start listening to it. When I had an eating disorder, I started listening. What are you in service of? Please tell me. I'm here to listen to you. I want to understand you. I don't want to fight you anymore because we've all been fighting. We've all been trying to be something different and fighting against the things that we don't want to be. And it's not working. So how about we try something else? Right? How about we start listening to what the purpose is of each thing that is happening? And then we start. Layla once said a phrase that stuck to me is she said, allowing is working with the energy of life itself.
Yeah.
So when I'm allowing things to be my procrastination, and then I take my procrastination into my laps and I say, talk to me, what's happening? Or my rigidity, and I stop fighting rigidity because I want to love and I think that it would be better for me to have my heart open. You don't know that.
No.
There's a reason why rigidity is there. Listen to it. Cuddle it. Becomes best friend with your rigidity. And then it's going to feel so safe that it can transform into something else. And this has also come from the tantric tradition. We don't get rid of things.
No.
We don't heal and then things get away. We don't do releases and then things go out. They transform.
Yeah.
Tantra is the path of transmutation. But you can't alchemize and you can't transform anything if you're fighting it.
Yeah.
If you're rejecting it. And what you're doing is you're creating more unsafety inside of yourself. So everything will persist.
Yeah. It's amazing to me how many clients I work with that will get to a point of like meeting some really tender part of them. And having a really challenging relationship with that part of them. But I just wish this part wasn't there. Like, I need to get rid of it somehow. I need to let it go. Like, the whole narrative, I need to just let this part of me go and then life will somehow be better because this happened ages ago. The reason this part of me is here is because of this thing that happened ages ago and that doesn't matter. I need to let it go and move forward. It's like, wait, pause. Like, can we just get curious about it? And give it space because it's like, if it's still there, it's still there for a reason and it has some form of message for you and it wants to be seen.
Yeah. And it's most likely taking care of something really important, really important. And you don't know you would be better off without it. I don't know that I would be better off without my eating disorder back then. Right? Like when I was a teenager, it started with compulsive overeating, which is what I hated the most. Mm. I had such an unstable childhood that food was the only thing that would soften me and bring me emotional tranquility. Like, I don't know what I would be without that.
Totally.
So thank you. And then when I started loving it, it was like, okay, Belle might not need our protection anymore. She finds soothing in herself. And then it went away just like that. No more compulsive overeating ever again.
Yeah. It's something that I find, and I was very similar, that I had the overeating thing. And I never really even realized that I did know it was a thing, but I didn't intentionally ever work on it. But I look back and there are quite a few patterns in my life that just disappeared through the process of doing body-based work. And it wasn't like I went into it being like, I need to change my relationship to food, or I need to somehow like stop. I can't remember any of the other things I used to do, but like some of the other really less healthy patterns that I had, they transmuted through care, really. And not through like care as in, oh, I'm going to have a bath. But obviously you can have a bath if that feels loving to you. But of like care of myself and listening and inquiry of like, what is actually going on inside of me right now? And what is this wanting to show me? I come from a background of like so much armoring around my heart, around my body. Mm-hmm. And it was very easy to like beat myself up in many ways for not being more open and not being more feminine and not being more like in that flowy vibe. But the more that I look at it and the more that I inquired, it's like, oh my God, this part of me is so terrified that like the only way that it knew to be safe in this world was to keep me incredibly rigid. And that served. Like if I had really been in the like deep, soft, open-hearted essence that I really believe is underneath it all true for me, life would have been so painful.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't have survived without that. Which is why I think I love this type of work so much, because it brings so much compassion for all of the patterns that as a society we have a tendency to shit on.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And I think like you said, it's not about becoming something else. Mm. It's about reconnecting with your essence, original essence that it already is.
Yep.
And then all the layers that it's not your original essence will dissolve through a loving eye, through a loving, compassionate way of looking at it.
How has this, because you're in a really loving, beautiful relationship at the moment, I'm wondering how this work has shifted your relational dynamics. Like, did you have you always in a relationship been loving and open-hearted, or do you resonate with any form of like avoidance or anxiety or any of that stuff that so many of us deal with?
So my relationship patterns, my entire life, they are, I date someone that is more anxious than me and I'm super avoidant. And then I get so tired and annoyed by that person that I break up with them. And then I find someone that is super avoidant. And then it's like, oh, it's thrilling and it's passionate. And I want that person so bad, but they're unavailable, right? So I get tired of that. And then I want something more stable. I want like someone that is safe. And then I find someone that is safe, but then they're anxious. And then I get annoyed. So that cycle goes on. And in all my long-term relationships, I was really like avoidant. And I used to tell my partners like, I get you feel that way, but you really need to take that to therapy. Cause like, I don't like, it's not my business, you know? And I know when I look back and I'm like, oh my God, I changed so much. When I tell my partner these stories, that he doesn't believe it because he's way more anxious than me, but I have such a safe attachment nowadays. when he brings out things, I can be loving towards him. I can understand where he's coming from most of the time. Sometimes I just want to roll my eyes and be like, are you serious? Like, I cannot believe you're bringing this up again. How is this not like handled inside of yourself? Like, you need to hold your inner child and take care of this. I don't know what to do with it. And I just get overwhelmed by their need for affection. But nowadays, what I can do is I can notice myself getting overwhelmed and my avoidant part is saying this. So maybe I need 15 minutes. You know, like I can communicate what's happening inside of myself because I know my avoidant is trying to protect me. What is it trying to protect me from? Affection feels unsafe.
Yeah.
Affection was unsafe for me in my upbringing. So, all right. So I can tell my partner my avoidant is saying this to me right now. But my wise adult, as Terry Real says, or my higher self, knows that I love you and we're going to be okay. And it makes sense that you want this. So we can separate our parts. And not identify. It's not that they're going away. So I think that's a big piece of it, right? It's not that they might not go away forever, but you don't identify yourself with them.
Yeah.
You're not crystallized in that identity.
It's like a process of being able to witness what is actually going on. I have noticed in myself there is a step between, there's a step of like complete unconsciousness, not realizing what's going on. And I had very similar patterns to you of a lot of really avoidant, unavailable men. And then some men that were quite anxious and me getting the ick and being like, oh, gross, like leave me alone. And then there was a phase of like, I am aware of what I'm doing and I can witness what is happening inside of me. And I will still play it out in this, like,
yeah.
I will be here and be like, oh, I'm being avoidant. Yeah, I'll still be avoidant. Here I am being avoidant. And then it's like, oh, and then there's an additional step of witnessing it, voicing it with awareness and bringing in the voice of the wise adult.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's, again, that's what Tantra is, right? Is bringing meditation to your everyday life. That's meditation. You witness your thoughts, you witness what's happening, but you do that like sitting or in a temple or whatever. And what Tantra invites us into is to be in a constant state of witness and meditation and allowing. And then all these pieces of ego, all these ideas that you had about yourself. Oh no, but I'm bossy. Oh no, but I'm rigid. Or oh no, but I'm timid. Like I'm shy. Or oh no, but because I'm very expensive. Like all of that starts dissolving. And then what I think is really like a bonus of that is that when people say things about you, like when my partner says something about me, oh, but you're so messy. That doesn't hurt me.
No,
I'm able to go like, you know, right? Like I am, like in the kitchen, I'm really messy. Like you're right. And then I don't feel so unsafe if the other person sees my shadows because I'm okay with them. Like I can, yeah, like I'm messy sometimes. And yeah, sometimes I forget to flush. Like, and it's fine that my partner brings that up and I'm okay with that. I don't fear that I'm going to lose love because I know that if I do, if he doesn't love me anymore, I'm going to be with myself and I'm going to be alone with myself so hard and I'm going to hold myself through that grief and I'm okay with that. And I think that non-abandonment brings a beautiful piece to relationships, which is allowing the relationship to be what is rather than holding on to what it should be. And oh, but we're going to be together forever and we're going to have kids and like all these projections to the future. I know that the moment that if Daniel doesn't love me anymore, or if I don't love him anymore, or the relationship doesn't work, like I'm going to get my things and I'm going to get out and it's okay.
Yeah.
And I'm going to accept the grief that I'm going to have to go through with that. It doesn't fear me. It really doesn't fear me.
I'm just going to turn the light on quickly. And then it's so dark. It's such a... It's such an interesting point for me because I feel like in most of my life, I have come from a world which is like, you start dating someone in your 20s, then you get married, then you have kids, and you're together forever. And there's this really interesting dynamic inside of me currently of being like, that is all a lie. Not to say that people don't get married and are happy forever and whatever, but that is really based on control. Mm. Like, okay, we're going to be together, we have to be together forever. Like, well, maybe, but we don't know.
Yeah.
And in many ways, I'm like, I'm not going to say that marriage is causing people suffering, because I don't think that's necessarily true. But I do wonder at times, I'm like, where is the link between like our own sovereign choice making and being in connection with ourselves and listening to ourselves and being in healthy relationship? Because the construct of marriage in some ways doesn't give space for that.
Yeah.
And I feel like we've been given a really, really limited relational blueprint of what it means to be in a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder at times if that is causing a huge amount of pain for people.
It is. It really is. Marriage until now was a political economic contract. And now, like, for the past generation, was the first time that marriage is actually like because of love.
Mm-hmm.
And if a couple doesn't love each other anymore, they can actually not be together anymore. Like, that's the first time we're living that. For the first time in history, like, a family staying together depends on the happiness of the couple.
Mm.
So, and we don't know how to love well. We, being in a conscious relationship, is questioning why it is that you're in a relationship. And when I ask people that, why do you want to be in a relationship, or why are you in a relationship, people tell me, oh, because I want to feel loved, or oh, because I want to be happy. And then I tell them, like, you're gonna be disappointed if that's why you're in a relationship, because sometimes you're not going to feel loved, and sometimes you're not going to be happy. And that doesn't mean that the relationship is failing. So you really need to stop and ask yourself, why do you want to be in a relationship? And it cannot be because this other person's going to give me something that's going to fulfill me.
Yeah.
That's going to create so much pain. So much pain.
So much pressure on another person. Like, if you flip it in reverse, like, imagine being with someone who was like, oh, the reason that we're together is because I'm hoping that you're going to give me happiness.
Yeah. Yeah. And people don't think about that, but that's what they are actually doing.
Mm. Well, it's what we've been told. It's what we've been told. And I, being single for God knows how long, I was single for, and I'm not shitting on being single, I had a great time, but there was definitely a period where I was like, I need a partner because a partner will make me belong because everybody else is in relationships. It will make me feel like I'm on the right path because that's what I should be doing at my age. And it will make me in some ways happy. And yes, there is beauty to like cohabiting with someone, having a partner through life. Of course, we're a social species. We are not meant to live in isolation. There is a balance between our spiritual life and the fact that we are a mammal in a physical body. And simultaneously, it's not the answer.
Mm-hmm.
It's like constant outsourcing and complaining about partners not giving us something, which is not something that they're meant to give us in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think we really need to ask ourselves this question, why am I in a relationship? And for me, it's because I want to learn how to love better.
Mm-hmm.
I want to learn how to love radically, like radically, which is why I am non-monogamous.
Mm-hmm.
So that when my partner falls in love with someone else, how can I love that person too? Or how can I love him when he wants to go out with her and not me? How can I not be stuck on conditions around love? How can I expand my love? You know, which has been such incredible journey. Like right now, I'm living in the house of someone that my partner was in a relationship with. Wow. Like I moved into her house and she moved into our house. and how, and I love her so, I love her deeply. Like, she's such an incredible person. When they got together, I called her, we talked, and we just, so anyways, I'm not going to go into that, but it's just, why are we in a relationship and where do we have to go in ourselves to stand for that? You know, if it is, I want to learn how to soften myself. I want to learn how to open my heart. That's going to mean you're going to have to hold yourself and open your heart when your partner doesn't make you happy or doesn't make you feel safe or didn't do the dishes again for the fifth time this week, you know, because that's why you're in the relationship.
Yeah. Rather than blaming the other person. And I feel like that piece of why I'm in a relationship can change as well. Like through the course of relationship, I'm constantly in this process of recognizing what it is mirroring back to me and being like, oh, like I recognized in myself recently this deep layer of shame that I was holding around not enoughness. And how much I project that outwards of like other people in my life must be perfect and shiny so that I feel good enough. There's any messiness that they bring into my life, any complication, any like weird dynamics or whatever, like that does not align with my persona that I like to put out to the world, which is shiny and got my shit together. And when I sat with that shame and I was like, oh my goodness, this is like, I'm so grateful to be in connection with this shame and to see it and to be like, okay, this is such an invitation for me to be like, this person is not a reflection of my worth. My worth is inherent. Like the partner that I choose has no relation to that.
Mm. Was it hard to sit with that shame?
I'm doing it daily. I've created a practice to sit with it daily. But when I first, I mean, I've recognized it for a long time, but when I've had the first like real deep body experience of it, I was like, oh my God, this is at the core of so much of my life.
Yeah. Mm. And that is the kind of thing that is keeping us rigid and away from pleasure.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of conditionings. And I find shame is so unconscious and hidden.
Like, it's so hidden. How is it so secret? I'm like, I've done so much body work. Where has this shame been the whole time?
It is incredible the places that that little thing can go into to not be found. And it's, oh, shame, it fascinates me, honestly. Like, it's the hardest thing I ever had to hold in my life, like experience deep body experiences of shame. And at the same time, in Sanskrit, there is this word that is musitatrapa, which means one whom sense of shame has been destroyed by love. Oh. And yes, right? So Sanskrit has 297 words for love. That's how abundant it is in love. And in English, we have like two. You know, like that's how sick and like poor we are in that. But anyways, I think it's such a, like, I think that's the biggest comprobation of the great cosmic joke, because the thing that makes us want to hide the most and the thing that is so hidden inside of us needs to be seen in love to be healed and dissolved and destroyed.
Yeah.
And it's the last thing that shame wants. But then when you sit with shame and you look at it in a loving eye, or someone, like when you bring this up here, there's a part of you that is more comfortable with people knowing that you have that.
Yeah.
So a huge piece of shame of, I don't need to hide myself, which is what keeps us from relationship most times. And I need to tense up and be something that I think people are going to like. But then if people get too close, then they're going to see all these other things that I'm trying to hide.
Yeah.
And so I sabotage my relationships, right? Shame is a huge piece of being in relationship and being in love and opening your heart. Like, it's at your shame.
And the other thing that's really interesting about it that I was thinking about a few weeks ago was, I obviously the shame was there. So like deep down, there was this part of me that was like, I don't feel worthy. I don't feel good enough. But my shame transmuted into grandiosity. So I had this huge sense in myself of like, these people aren't good enough for me. Like, I need better than this. I am this high achiever. I deserve blah, blah, blah. Like, I'm worthy of this magical love. Like, a lot of the narrative, to be honest, that the spiritual world and this personal development world keep proliferating. But it was an ego trap of like, I am amazing. And it's like, grandiosity is just shame flipped on its head.
Yeah.
It's like, how did I not see that? And I think about so many high achieving women who have the same thing. I don't know how many clients have said to me, like, I'm just really afraid that I'm going to end up meeting a partner that's like got no money or like has some shit house. And it's like, it's the same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. The traps. It's the like tricks and the traps of the human psyche.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, it's fascinating.
It really is. I wonder, as we come towards the end, this is a big question to ask you towards the end, but what do you feel like tantric philosophy has done for you in terms of expanding your sense of what is possible in partnership?
Oh, everything. Like, it changed everything. So tantra invites us to go from safe relating to awaken relating. So I'm not in partnership because, again, I want you to make me feel loved or safe, or and I don't try to control you, or I don't try to make you something that you're not, but rather it's a deep, profound shift on what are the parts of myself that I haven't seen. What are the parts of myself that I don't allow myself to see, that I'm ashamed that the other person's going to see? And what about the other person I don't accept? Where am I not able to hold a loving and compassionate look towards the other person? Mm. Where's my judgment, my criticism? Where all of these conditions show up? And how can I work on them to come closer to enlightenment, which is the goal, ultimate, one of the goals of tantra, which is enlightenment, right? So every time my partner pisses me off, or I judge something that he does, or a way that he is, or how he deals with his clothes, or how he dresses, or how much effort he puts into his studies and into his work, I shift that towards myself. Mm. And then I meet those parts of myself. Mm. And then again, I can do the work around them to transform them. So partnership in tantra is like, to me, this is my perspective, is the ultimate spiritual practices, because you're going to be daily facing the things that are keeping you from your true essence. Mm. Your partner is the person that is going to trigger you the most. And yes, you can create a bunch of rules and boundaries and what you can do and what you cannot do and da-da-da. Or you can go into yourself. Mm. And when I say this, I'm talking about a healthy relationship, right? I'm not talking about abusive or violent relationship where you constantly think that it's your fault that you're being hurt. I'm not talking about that.
Yeah,
I'm talking about healthy relationships in which you're going to feel so much pain, you're going to feel so triggered, because that's what your partner is meant to do. And if it can do it with love, then you found the right partner.
Yeah. God, I love that so much. Thank you so much for being here with us. Can I ask you one final question that will be a faster one?
Of course.
I ask everyone this question. What does it mean to you to live a liberated life?
To love fully, with no strings, no conditions of who I should or should not love, who is okay to accept and who's not. Just to That's my goal in life, is to love the people who have harmed me, or the people that I compare myself with, or to love fully.
Belle, you are such a gift. Thank you so much for coming on this with me. I feel like, yeah, I feel softer in myself even just listening to you. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. You're a huge inspiration for me too.
And where can people find you? I know that a lot of your work is in Portuguese. Is that right?
Yeah. On Instagram, I put some English subtitles on my videos. Mm. So my Instagram is bell.litsek. Mm. And I see clients, I see international, I have quite a few international clients actually. Mm. So I do have sessions in English. Mm. But yes, most of my content, I speak in Portuguese.
Everyone go and follow Belle. She is incredibly wise and will also just give you huge Brazilian envy. But she's also incredibly wise, which is the main piece.
Oh, I love that.
Thank you
so much. Thank you, Lucy.